Good morning. This is the Friday Morning Zine on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder. This is KSJD's fall membership drive going on right now. Call us up at 970-564-0808 or pledge securely online at ksjd.org to support programming like the zine that we bring you every weekday morning. Chuck Greaves is a writer who spent 25 years as a trial lawyer in Los Angeles before moving to Santa Fe in 2006 to pursue a writing career. He's now a resident of Montezuma County here in southwest Colorado. His award-winning debut novel, Hush Money, was the first installment in the Jack McTaggart series of legal mysteries. Chuck's latest novel, Hard Twisted, is a work of literary fiction based on a Depression-era true crime, the story of a homeless man and his 13-year-old daughter who are befriended by a Texas drifter newly released from a federal penitentiary. The novel imagines their flight through New Mexico and Colorado and their eventual appearance in Blanding, Utah. The story culminates in four Utah killings and the notorious Greenville, Texas skeleton murder trial of 1935. Chuck is currently at work on his next historical novel, and the third installment of the Jack McTaggart series, The Last Air, will be in bookstores nationwide in June of 2014. And he joins me now in the KSJD studios. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Tom.
Can you give our listeners just a brief overview of what happens in the book Hard Twisted?
You gave a pretty good summary. Basically, the story begins in Dust Bowl, Depression era, southeastern Oklahoma, where a homeless man and his 13-year-old daughter are befriended by a charismatic drifter just released from prison, a man named Clint Palmer. And Clint Palmer lures father and daughter down to Texas, where, unbeknownst to the 13-year-old girl, Lottie Garrett, he kills her father and kidnaps Lottie and takes her on a one-year crime spree across the American Southwest.
Now, let's back up, because I think what's really fascinating about this book is how this book came to be, sort of the genesis of it. Let's back up to the time when you were spending some time in southeast Utah, and let's talk about some events that really got the ball rolling for this book for you.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. Actually, in 1994, my wife and I, who's also a lawyer, we were living in Los Angeles, and we traveled to the Valley of the Gods, Utah, in San Juan County, and met some friends of ours from Cortez, and we stayed at a bed and breakfast there in the Valley of the Gods, and we went hiking one day. This was the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, and we were out hiking, and as we were heading back to our car toward the early afternoon, it began to snow. And you know how when you're out in the snow and things get really hushed and quiet, we were walking along the valley floor in a place called John's Canyon, and we stumbled upon two human skulls. And just as we knelt down to look at our discovery, a thunderclap rolled down the canyon and shook the ground under our feet during the snowstorm. And we just looked at each other and said, wow. And that discovery is what started me on what turned out to be a 15-year 15-year odyssey, if you will, to find out whose skulls they were, how had they gotten there, and to unravel the whole story.
How did the discovery of those two skulls lead to this story of Clint Palmer and Lottie and this crime spree that happened in the Depression era?
Well, the first thing we did is we went to a woman named Doris Valley, who, by the way, used to live in Cortez. But Doris, for many years, ran the trading post in Mexican Hat, Utah. And she was an historian, and she wrote a history of the area. And she told us a story about a notorious double murder that happened in Johns Canyon in 1935. And she believed that those skulls, which we were not the first people to find, were somehow connected to that double murder. And so the story fascinated us, especially the aspect of the 13-year-old girl being sort of an accomplice to this whole ordeal. So we began doing research, and we started with the San Juan Record newspaper, and we traced the story back to its origin in Oklahoma and Texas. We looked at newspaper accounts, we looked at court records, we looked at prison records, and eventually the story we uncovered was much more interesting than even we had hoped it would be.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Friday Morning Zine on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder. My guest this morning is Chuck Greaves, and we're talking about his latest novel called Hard Twisted, that is a story about true crime that happened in the Depression era. I'm curious, you know, as you're unraveling this thing, you're getting into a lot of recorded history, things that are based in fact. And then you take those facts and you turn them into a work of fiction, literary fiction. Tell me a little bit about that process. How do you fill in those gaps that obviously aren't there in the historical record, but yet as a writer, you've got to really flesh out the story around things that you really can't know in some respect.
Yeah, there were gaps in the historical record. When I actually began the research, I was thinking that if I ever did a book about these events, it would be nonfiction. But once I sat down to write, I realized that there were too many gaps in the story. And I concluded that the best way to deal with the material was to write it as a novel and fill in the gaps with fiction. So what I did was I took the facts that were known, and of course you have to pick and choose which facts you're going to put on the page and which you're going to leave out. But so I took the facts that were known, and in those areas where there was nothing in the historical record, I filled it in. And of course, even in those areas where we knew what the facts were, I had to create the dialogue, create the internal thought processes, things like that. So it is a novel, but it does fairly accurately track the true events and what actually happens to the people involved.
Were you able to go and talk to family members that were related to some of the people in your story and fill in that way, sort of to get an idea of some of the personalities? Because I could imagine that's really where the difficulty is that you have no idea what these personalities were like based on maybe court evidence and those kinds of things. Was there family members or other ways that you were able to get at the real people behind the story?
Largely no, although I was in communication with the girl. Her name is Lottie Garrett. I was in communication with her daughter-in-law. Hmm. Lucille Garrett actually died in the 1970s. I was able to connect with her son and her son's wife, and we mostly exchanged emails and exchanged written materials back and forth. So, no, I didn't have that tool in my toolbox, but I did have a lot of written material, including not the trial transcript, but I did have newspaper accounts of the eventual trial of Clint Palmer for the murder of Lottie Garrett, the girl's father, which took place in Texas. And I also had access to some witness statements and grand jury testimony that were given by the girl, Lottie Garrett, by Clint Palmer's father, and by Harry Goulding, who ran Goulding's Trading Post, for whom Clint Palmer and Lottie Garrett were actually working at the time of the double murder in Utah.
Working as a trial lawyer, I can imagine that getting into a writing career, it must be quite liberating to be able to say, you know what, I don't have to just stick to the facts anymore. Now I can open up into this world of fiction and fill in some of these ideas and some of these storylines around this hard evidence that you have from, as it turns out, these trial documents and these newspaper accounts. Does it feel that way for you? Is this kind of a sense of like, oh, I can finally get to this story that I've always wanted to get into, as opposed to just being, you know, standing before a jury and only being able to present the absolute cold hard facts?
Well, I think a lot of my courtroom opponents would say that when I made the switch from being a trial lawyer to writing fiction, it wasn't that great of a change. But no, it's a very different thing, obviously. I think, you know, as I've become an author and I've met other authors, I think there are three professions that are overrepresented in the world of fiction, and those are journalists, advertising people, and lawyers. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that all three involve a sort of reductive process where you're taking a very sort of complex fact pattern in the case of for a lawyer, or a complex story in the case of a journalist, and you're boiling it down to its essence. In advertising, you take a broad concept and reduce it to maybe a slogan or a bumper sticker. So I think that process of reducing the complex to the digestible is very good training for writing fiction. And I think it's reflected in how many, as I say, journalists and lawyers end up being authors.
But don't you think, too, that readers, or people that are even reading advertisements for that matter, that's what we want. We want things to be simplified. We want it to be boiled down to the most essential so that we can, as you say, sort of digest them easier. That complexity, it adds this gray area to things, and that we can't get to the so-called truth of the matter.
Well, you want it to be digestible. You want it to be entertaining. You want it to be well-paced. You want it to be, you know, as a writer, it's my job to make you want to turn the page and get to that next chapter and not put the book down. So that's part of it. And you have to be selective, obviously. You can spend a lot of time. You can get lost in the weeds of details and make it very uninteresting for your readers. You have to strike a balance, obviously, and so that's part of the art of writing fiction.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Friday Morning Zine on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder. It is our fall membership drive going on right now. Support programming like you get here every weekday morning on the zine. We bring in different guests in the world of art and culture and people who are involved in politics and people who are in the news in our area here in the Four Corners area. Put a value on that. Give us a call, 970-564-0808, or you can pledge securely online at ksjd.org. I'm pretty sure we still have some money from the challenge match put down by the board of directors, so give us a call right now and double your dollars with your donation to KSJD. My guest this morning is Chuck Greaves. He's an author. His latest novel, Hard Twisted, is about a Depression-era true crime. One tie-in that I'd really love to talk to you about that's very interesting about the novel Hard Twisted is this tie-in to the possible demise of Everett Roos, who has been written extensively and has been a large part of the people talking about this sort of mystery of Southeast Utah. Tell me a little bit about that, and how does Everett Roos possibly tie into the story of Clint Palmer?
Well, I had no idea that there might be a connection until, while doing my research, I found a newspaper account. It was a front page story of the double murder, and the headline, this was in early March of 1935. The headline read, "Double Murder Shocks County," and it was a story of how Clint Palmer, my main character, shot and killed the former sheriff of San Juan County, Utah, a man named Bill Oliver, and his grandson, a young man named Norris Shumway. And that story ran in the left-hand column of the newspaper. The next column over, I noticed at the very bottom there was a reference to a story about a missing artist who had gone missing in Davis Gulch, Utah, and they had found his pack burrows and some of his effects, but they were unable to find him. And I thought, holy mackerel, that's Everett Roos. They didn't mention his name in the newspaper account. And that got me to thinking. And as I started to piece the timeline together, I realized that there was a period of time where Clint Palmer, who was 36 years old, and his 13-year-old child bride, Lottie Garrett, were living in Johns Canyon in a dugout. This was in the winter of 1934, 1935. And what happened was Lottie became pregnant. Mm. And she went first to Goulding's Trading Post on Thanksgiving Day, and then to Monticello to have her baby. And she returned to Johns Canyon to reunite with Clint Palmer in early January. So there was a period of time between Thanksgiving and just after New Year's where Clint Palmer was alone in Johns Canyon, psychotic, heavily armed, had already killed three people, and was about to kill two more people. And it was exactly at that time that Everett Roos disappeared, okay, in Davis Gulch in Utah. Now, we know from subsequent evidence that it's most likely that Everett Roos was hiking eastbound on the north side of the San Juan River because one of his Nemo graffiti
inscriptions, yeah,
right, mm-hmm. was found in Grand Gulch some years later by a man named Kent Slight. And so if you accept that as true, that he set out from Davis Gulch in November of 1934, went into Grand Gulch. The next gulch over, the next canyon over, is Johns Canyon. And if he had walked into Johns Canyon, he almost certainly would have encountered Clint Palmer. And as I said, Clint Palmer at that time was alone, heavily armed, and dangerously psychotic. So did it happen? I don't know. Nobody knows what happened to Everett Roos. But I think when you talk about what did happen to Everett Roos, it's something you have to consider.
That's a very, very interesting coincidence right there, the proximity of Clint Palmer. What's coming up next for you? You're working on your, or maybe you've finished this last installment in your Jack McTaggart series. You're also getting ready to do another historical kind of novel. Talk a little bit about what you're working on right now.
Sure. It's another interesting backstory. When I lived in L.A., I had a good friend. We used to ride horses, my wife and I, at a riding club. And I met a gal named Cece Levy. And I knew her father was a famous trial lawyer from New York back in the day. And I later learned that he actually represented the gangster Lucky Luciano in a very famous criminal trial that took place in 1936, in which the prosecutor was a man named Tom Dewey, who became governor of New York, almost became president of the United States. In that case, a very famous prosecution, Lucky Luciano was convicted of basically being the head of a vice ring involving prostitution in New York. He was sentenced to 50-some years in prison. And that was the first major criminal prosecution designed to break organized crime in New York. It was a very famous trial. Well, Cece said, you know, when my dad died in the 1970s, we packed up all of his files from his office, and I stored them in a barn in upstate New York. And I said, you know, Cece, I'd love to go look at those files if you wouldn't mind. So I flew to New York, and I drove upstate, and sure enough, in this barn, I found 15 rusting file drawers under a moldering tarp. I went through all the drawers, and I found George Morton Levy's trial file in People versus Luciano. And so I actually have that file in my office here in Cortez. And so that fascinated me. And I thought that would be a heck of a good story to follow four different characters, namely Tom Dewey, Lucky Luciano, George Morton Levy, and a prostitute named Cokie Flo Brown, and follow the four of them as their lives converge on a courtroom in New York in 1936. So that's the story I'm writing right now, in four alternating voices in alternating chapters.
Wow. Sounds really, really interesting. Fascinating story. Is there something about that sort of 30s era that it seems like you're kind of focused a little bit on that era? Is there something that holds a special allure for you about that time period?
Purely coincidence. although it's interesting. When you write, you know, historical fiction, you have to be accurate because people will call you on it if you're not. And so in the course of writing Hard Twisted, I ended up doing a lot of research on little things that you would never imagine would become issues. Like you're writing a scene where somebody opens a jar and you say, gee, did they have screw cap jars in 1935? Or you're writing a scene where somebody gets into a tent and you say, gee, did tents have zippers in 1935? So you end up doing all this arcane research. And it just so happens that with this new story being also set in the 30s, I guess I have a head start because I've done a lot of that research on trivial things.
You know, here at KSJD, we have a story vault. It's a little one-on-one recording studio that we put in the old bank vault of the old building here. And we're encouraging people to come in and tell stories and talk about you know, either just really interesting events and adventures they may have had, or even just get family members to come in and tell stories about their lives and do more of kind of an oral history kind of thing. And I'm curious from your perspective as an author, when you look and you're trying to search for these little nuggets of these things, talk about your use of oral history. Do you get a chance to dig into either documents or even audio recordings from time to time as it relates to trying to flesh out these events from years and years ago?
Actually, I did. In the case of Hard Twisted, I had access to the Southeast Utah Oral History Project, which is a project run by Dr. Gary Shumway out of Cal State Fullerton in Los Angeles. Dr. Shumway turned me on to this project. Basically, what he did for a number of years, he would have students from Cal State Fullerton come to southeastern Utah over the summer and interview the old-timers around town and collect these great oral history materials. And it turned out I had access to that material. There were a number of firsthand accounts of the Johns Canyon murders, a number of firsthand accounts of Posey's War, which was the last Indian uprising in America, which plays a role in the book, and a number of fascinating things like that. So They did a great job of recording these interviews, transcribing them, and importantly, indexing them so they were accessible by subject matter. And I have some great material that I use in the book.
So you just never know when you come in and tell your story, who knows what's going to happen with that and what kinds of truths or things that you've experienced in your life that an author decades from now may end up writing about you.
Exactly. 30 years later, some author came along and took my story and used it. For example, there's a great an oral history tape recording that I listened to in which a woman described having met Lottie Garrett when she was a little girl. She met Lottie Garrett, who was also a little girl. And she remembers her coming into her home. And she remembers her father telling a story about Clint Palmer. He was a gambler. About Clint Palmer playing poker. And he would have Lottie sit behind her. This is a terrible story. I don't tell this on the radio. But he would sit behind her with no underwear on to try to distract the other players, which is a tragic anecdote, but a fascinating element to use in a story. And of course I did use that in the book. So there's an example of something that nobody ever would have known about had it not been recorded in this oral history project.
Well, and it speaks volumes about the character of Clint Palmer.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can really get a sense of how diabolical he really was.
And how manipulated the young girl was.
Sure.
It's a classic story of the Stockholm syndrome, which we know about now. Of course they didn't know about it then. That's reflected in, not to give too much away, but at the end of the book, the girl herself actually gets prosecuted for being an accessory to these events, even though she was 13 and 14 years old and kidnapped, impregnated, brainwashed. It's a really tragic story.
Chuck, thanks so much for joining me this morning and talking about your book and how you write. It's been really, really fascinating.
Great, Tom. Thank you for having me.
This has been the Friday Morning Zine. I'm Tom Yoder. My guest this morning is Chuck Greaves. He's a writer. His latest novel, Hard Twisted, is available right now in paperback, and he's working on his next historical novel right now. His third installment of the Jack McTaggart series, The Last Air, will be in bookstores nationwide June of 2014.